Okay, so what I want to do now is take a look at the sutta description of the jhanas and the first four jhanas and see how that fits with what I've been talking about. The jhanas show up in probably more than 100 suttas, but they always show up pretty much the same. Because the suttas were an oral tradition, whatever variety was there sort of got folded into these stock phrases. And so when you're chanting a sutta, because these were chanted, and you got to the jhana part, you just chanted the jhana thing. Right? And so there's not much variety. Some places have less than others, but what I've got here is about the most detail you'll find. You'll find a little tiny bit more in a few other suttas, but this is about it. The sutta that I'll be reading from is the second discourse in the long discourses, the Samanyapala Sutta, the discourse on the fruits of the spiritual life. I particularly like that sutta because it's an example of the gradual training. The gradual training is the curriculum for the monks and nuns. This is what they needed to undertake in order to become fully awakened. And it's keeping the precepts, guarding the senses, being mindful of all your activities, being content with little, abandoning the hindrances, practicing the jhanas, gaining insight into the nature of reality, and then eventually overcoming the asavas, the intoxicants, the things that cloud our minds, so we can see clearly and gain freedom by making the breakthrough to awakening. So this is the jhana section, and it starts out quite secluded from sense pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states. This refers to the abandoning of the hindrances. What comes immediately before the jhanas is the abandoning of the hindrances, the hindrance of sense desire, of ill will and hatred, sloth and torpor, restlessness and worry, skeptical doubt. The method that we're using to abandon the hindrances is generating access concentration. You might notice when you get distracted, you're wanting something, or you're wanting to get rid of something, or you're falling asleep, or you've got too much energy, or you're doubting. All right? So most of your distractions would fall into one of these five categories. If you get to access concentration, you're no longer getting distracted, and you're no longer under the sway of the hindrances. Okay? So that's the technique that we're using. So, quite secluded from sense pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, one enters and dwells in the first jhana, which is accompanied by thinking and examining, and is filled with the rapture and happiness born of seclusion. One drenches deep, saturates, and suffuses one's body with this rapture and happiness born of seclusion, so there is no part of one's entire body not suffused by this rapture and happiness. Okay, so secluded from the hindrances, and you generate the access concentration, and then it just says one enters and remains in the first jhana. Right, it's a little bit left out right there. So the whole thing about once you're at access concentration, then shift your attention to a pleasant sensation and focus on the pleasant sensation, letting go of the breath or metta or whatever you're using for access method, and just hang out focused on the pleasant sensation, then the jhana arises. And that didn't get spelled out here. And then it says the first jhana, which is accompanied by, well, the Pali words are vitaka and vichara. You often hear those described as initial and sustained attention to the meditation object, which is what they mean in the later commentarial tradition. But to the Buddha, vitaka meant thinking, and vichara meant examining or pondering. Okay? So what it's saying is that in the first jhana, that background, those wispy background thoughts I mentioned could be there at access. Yeah, they're still there at the first jhana. And then the jhana is filled with piti and sukha, rapture and happiness, born of seclusion, born of the fact that you have abandoned the hindrances. getting to access concentration, yeah, that's pretty nice. And so now you can find some pleasure, focus on it, and the jhana arises. You might sometimes hear there's five factors for the first jhana, which is usually given as vitaka, vichara, pitisukha, and ekagata, which means one-pointedness. But you didn't hear anything about any one-pointedness here. They threw that in later. Okay. For the Buddha, only four things get mentioned, and two of them aren't really factors. I would say thinking and examining is a defect rather than a factor. So what happened in Buddhism is after the Buddha's death, they composed more suttas, and then they eventually stopped composing suttas, and they started composing Abhidhamma. And the Abhidhamma was an attempt to systematize the Buddha's teachings. And, well, they went a little overboard. It was like you have a bicycle, and you take it all apart so that you can understand what it's like to coast down a long hill with the wind going by and you exerting no energy. Yeah, you don't find that amongst the pieces. Well, that was the Abhidhamma project, unfortunately. So they systematized everything and broke it into these factors, and the whole concept of factors actually isn't really very useful. It's all it's saying is you got some background thinking and lots of piti and sukha. In the first jhana, the piti, the physical energy, predominates. Okay? So you put your attention on that pleasant sensation and it built and it turns into piti, and hopefully it brings with it the sukha, and you are having a piti sukha experience. At first you may not even be able to tell the difference. Oh, this is piti, this is sukha. Doesn't matter. And you're sustaining this piti sukha experience. Now it says, one drenches deep, saturates, and suffuses one's body with the rapture and happiness born of seclusion. So there is no part of one's entire body not suffused by this rapture and happiness, this piti and sukha. That's an advanced practice, okay? First, you want to get in there the first time. And then you want to get in there the second time. And then you want to get in there repeatedly and be able to sustain the piti and sukha. Most people find that when it comes on, it's sort of the upper torso, neck, head, maybe the spine. That's all that's really happening. But once you get good at getting the piti sukha there, then you can move it throughout your body. And the technique is very simple. Go to where you feel the piti and sukha, put your attention there, and then move your attention down into some place where you don't feel the piti sukha. And then repeat it again for the other parts. And yeah, take about a minute or two of just, you know, moving your attention and coming back and feeling what you got and moving your attention again until you've moved it through the whole body. And the piti and sukha will follow. And at that point, you've got the jhana stable and fully developed. If the jhana, if the piti is really strong, you won't want to stay in the first jhana very long. It just, you know, putting your finger in the electrical socket, you don't want to do that for a long time. You pull it right out. Okay? If it's mild, you might stay there for 5 or 10 minutes. I would say 10 minutes is a maximum for running the piti. Beyond that, well, it leaves you a little fried. It's just a little bit too much energy. Okay? So if it's a really strong PT, short time. If it's mild PT, you could stay up for up to 10 minutes. And you hang out there, just, yeah, focused on this experience of PT Sukha. We have a simile. Suppose a skilled bath attendant or his apprentice were to pour soap flakes into a metal basin, sprinkle them with water and knead them into a ball so that the ball of soap flakes would be pervaded by moisture, encompassed by moisture, suffused with moisture inside and out, and yet would not trickle. In the same way, one drenches deep, saturates, and suffuses one's body with the rapture and happiness born of seclusion, so there is no part of one's entire body not suffused by this rapture and happiness. So at the time of the Buddha, if you needed a bar of soap, you didn't go to Sainsbury's and buy a bar of soap. You got your skilled bath attendant to take a metal basin, pour in soap flakes, pour in water, and then mix the soap flakes in the water until they had a ball of soap. Okay? This is actually pretty good for showing the frenetic energy of piti. Piti is not tranquil. We think of meditation getting very tranquil. When the piti hits, it's not tranquil at all. And this mixing, yeah, that's not a tranquil thing. And then getting the water completely through the soap, that's like when you get the piti sukha completely through your body. Okay, so it's a pretty good simile as to what's going on. So you hang out in this state for a while. And as I said, if the piti's too much, it's quite a short while. There have been times when I stayed in the first jhana for as little as 10 seconds. Having played with it now for, 27 years, I know how to crank it up really, really strong. And it's like, okay, enough. And then I'll move on towards the second jhana. So if you've had enough of the piti, the trick is take a deep breath. Remember I said if you're trying to get to the first jhana, don't take a deep breath. It'll take you away from the piti. Now when you've had enough piti, take a deep breath. It'll take you away from the piti. So you're all wired up with this piti and really deep breath. And as you let the energy out, really exhale. And the piti will come down in intensity. So you basically in the first jhana, you've got the piti in the foreground and the sukha in the background. You take the nice deep breath and they both decrease, but the piti decreases much more. And now you can focus on the sukha, the happiness, the joy. That's the move to get to the second jhana. Further, with the subsiding of thinking and examining, one enters and remains in the second jhana. Okay, so the thinking is supposed to all go away in the second jhana. You come on a 10-day retreat, you're probably not going to get that concentrated. It's probably going to take a much longer retreat to get the level of concentration where the thinking all goes away. But it gets quieter. Whereas in the first jhana, there might be thoughts like, yeah, this is pretty intense. Wow, how long do I want to stay here? In the second jhana, the thoughts have more gaps between them. It's like, oh, cool. This is nice. You know, as opposed to one sentence after the other. So one enters and dwells in the second jhana, which is accompanied by inner tranquility and unification of mind. When you take that deep breath and calm the piti down, yeah, things get a lot more tranquil. So this is where the tranquility comes in. The breath, the exhale of that breath is the move towards the tranquility. And then you really let your mind collect around the experience of sukha. That's now your focus. So before, you were focused on things that were physical, like the breath, and then on the pleasant sensation, and then on the piti and sukha. But in the second jhana, the piti's in the background, and the sukha, this emotional state, is now your foreground object, and that's what you're focused on. The piti, instead of being really vibratory or a lot of heat or anything like that, probably will show up as some rocking or maybe some swaying, something like that. A little bit of energy there. And happiness is what you're focused on. The unification of mind is around the happiness. So and it says that the second jhana is without vitaka and vichara. So it's really saying you're getting quite quiet and filled with rapture and happiness born of concentration. The rapture and happiness of the first jhana was born of seclusion from the hindrances. And for the second jhana, it's the concentration of the first jhana that gives you the different sort of rapture and happiness. Once again, one drenches deep, saturates, and suffuses one's body with this rapture and happiness born of concentration. So there is no part of one's entire body which is not suffused by this rapture and happiness. Again, this is an advanced practice. You want to get to the second jhana, and then you want to get there repeatedly, and you want to be able to sustain it. The happiness is a much more subtle object. It's far more subtle than the piti of the first jhana, but it's also more subtle than the pleasant sensation or even the breath. So you need good concentration, right? So you need to practice. Okay, here's the happiness. Let me see if I can stay with it. And when you find that you can stay with it, the sense of location in the body has shifted down. Most people say that the happiness seems to be coming out of the heart center. And then, okay, then just move your attention from wherever it is down into your extremities, wherever it isn't. You know, nice and slow, taking about a minute to cover everything. And you'll find that the happiness, with a little background PT, seems to be all pervasive. The happiness, well, it's like it's your birthday. And somebody gives you a really nice present. And you open it up and it's like, oh, wow, I always wanted one of these. Thank you, thank you. Okay, but it's not being generated by something external. It's being generated by your concentrated mind. The present didn't put the happiness in your mind. The present only triggered the happiness. The happiness in your mind is a neurological pathway that's gotten lit up. You've got to figure out how to light up that pathway in order to experience happiness. Mostly we're dependent on something external lighting up that pathway. Learning to be proficient at the second jhana means learning to light up that pathway with your concentration. So you become independent of other things in order to be happy. So it's a really nice state to be able to hang out in. We have a simile. Suppose there were a deep lake whose waters welled up from below. It would have no inlet for water from the east, west, north, nor south, nor would it be refilled from time to time with showers of rain. Yet a current of cool water welling up from within the lake would drench deep, saturate, and suffuse the whole lake, so there would be no part of the entire lake which is not suffused with the cool water. In the same way, one drenches deep, saturates, and suffuses one's body with the rapture and happiness born of concentration, so that there is no part of one's entire body which is not suffused by rapture and happiness. Okay, so the simile is a lake. No streams coming in, no rain, but a spring at the bottom of the lake. And the spring water would totally fill the lake, would totally permeate the lake. This is an amazingly accurate picture of what the second jhana feels like. When I first learned the second jhana, Ayakema didn't read out this simile. And it was only a year later. So I'd been practicing the second jhana for quite a while. And I remember on the retreat, she reads the simile, and I go, wow, that's exactly what it's like. And so she finishes the Dharma talk and leaves the hall, and I go running after her. Ayakema, it's just like that, it's just like that. And she laughed because, yeah, it really feels like you've got a wellspring of happiness. And it's just this happiness that's just coming up and flooding your whole being. And it's quite a nice place to hang out. For the second jhana, because it doesn't have that intense PT, you can stay there, well, depending on your skill, indefinitely. Half an hour if you wanted to. But I would say learn to stay for 10 to 15 minutes. Again, I give you a rather indefinite amount of time because your time sense is going to be quite distorted. But yeah, you want to get the happiness going and just hang out with it and ride it. It seems to come up and then get a little weaker and then come back up. That, I suspect, is due to the PT. All right, the PT sort of comes up a bit, makes it feel like it's stronger, and then the PT fades away. And yeah, and just hang out with this. It's not a big change, but just hang out with this happiness that's there for, like I say, 10 to 15 minutes. Then you've got skill in it. Then, with the fading away of rapture, one dwells in equanimity, mindful and clearly comprehending, and experiences happiness with the body. Thus one enters and dwells in the third jhana, of which the noble ones declare, one dwells happily with equanimity and mindfulness. One drenches deep, saturates, and suffuses one's body with the happiness free from rapture, so there is no part of one's entire body which is not suffused by this happiness. Okay, so the first thing, the fading away of the PT, the rapture. Sometimes it just goes away on its own, and things calm down even more. If you want to move on your own from the second to the third jhana, again, you can take a breath and let the energy out. And as you let it out, you want to find the volume control on the happiness and turn it down from joy, happiness, to contentment. The third jhana is a state of wishlessness, of contentment, of satisfaction. of satisfaction so strong that if Mick Jagger had been practicing the third jhana, he couldn't sing that song. I mean, you got satisfaction, right? So one thing that can be helpful is take the breath, you start turning down the volume on the happiness, and then remember a time when you were very contented. I don't know, you just eaten the perfect meal, you didn't overeat, and you don't have to wash the dishes. Right? And you pluck the feeling of contentment out of that memory. So turn down the volume on the happiness, brief memory, quarter second, grab the feeling of contentment, and now the happiness becomes the contentment, and this is what you're focused on, this feeling of wishlessness. There should be no PT left, and so it should be very still. If there's any sense of movement, that's leftover PT, and you didn't quite get there. You just got to a lower level of the second jhana. But in the third jhana, yeah, you're very contented, and everything is very still. It feels like it's lower down. If the second jhana was in the heart center, the third jhana is in the belly. Right? So as the numbers go up, the physical sense goes down. In fact, the physical sense is stronger than the sense of the numbers. So if I have a student who is practicing the second jhana and they say, and then I went down to the next jhana, I don't know if they meant down to three because it feels physically down, or down to one because the number went down, and I have to actually ask them. At one point I was doing some meditation in an fMRI and they were going to tell me when to move between the jhanas. So I would signal with a little clicker that I had arrived. And they would tell me in the earphone, go to the first jhana. And when I got there, I'd click. I told them, don't take the first 10 seconds after I click. Let me reestablish, okay? And they said, and we'll just tell you to go to go up or down. And I was like, no, you don't tell me to go up or down, because I won't know whether you mean up numerically or up physically. And I don't want to have to try and figure that out in the really concentrated state. Just say next and previous. Okay, the down and up is so physically, you know, feeling of going down as the numbers go up. So it's lower in the body. And then, again, it doesn't feel like it's everywhere. Then just move your attention to the places where you don't feel like you have the contentment. And, yeah. Over a minute or so, it'll feel like you've got it fully there. But as in the previous two, this is an advanced practice. First get in, get it stable. Once it's really feeling stable, then you can try the movement. Because the contentment is far more subtle than the happiness of the second. The jhanas are in increasing subtlety of object. As the numbers go up, the objects get more and more subtle, which would be what you would expect if you're trying to deepen your concentration. Again, we have a simile. Suppose in a lotus pond there were blue, white, or red lotuses that have been born in the water, grow in the water, and never rise up above the water, but flourish immersed in the water. From their tips to their roots, they would be drenched, steeped, saturated, and suffused with water, so there would be no part of those lotuses not suffused with water. In the same way, one drenches deep, saturates, and suffuses one's body with a happiness free from rapture, so there is no part of one's entire body which is not suffused by this happiness. Okay, so the picture is of a lotus pond with lotuses coming up out of the mud, but not above the surface of the water. They're leading their whole lives underwater. This is a very still picture, right? You got no lotuses bobbing up and down. You got no lotuses waving in the breeze. They're just underwater, a bit isolated from the world around you, which is also the feeling of the third jhana. You're really getting quite deeply inward and very still. It's actually quite an accurate picture of what's going on. So once again, you want to be able to stay there the 10 to 15 minutes. And then, further, with the abandoning of pleasure and pain, and with the previous passing away of joy and grief, one enters and dwells in the fourth jhana, which is neither pleasant nor painful and contains mindfulness fully purified by equanimity. One sits suffusing one's body with a pure, bright mind, so there is no part of one's entire body not suffused by the pure, bright mind. Okay, so the move from the third to the fourth jhana, you abandon pleasure and pain and the previous passing away of joy and grief. Don't make the mistake of thinking there's pain or grief in any of the jhanas. This is pointing to a neutral state. You're going to an emotionally neutral state. The first jhana with all that piti and sukha, yeah, very, very pleasant, very positive. Second one, yeah, that's really pleasant with all that happiness and joy. Third one, contentment. Contentment's pleasant. Now you're going to neutral. So there was joy in the first two, and there was pleasure in the first three, but the fourth one is very neutral. One enters and dwells in the fourth jhana, which is neither pleasant nor painful, and contains mindfulness fully purified by equanimity. Basically, what you're doing as you move through these jhanas is you're enhancing your capacity to be mindful. All right? So, yeah, you can be mindful just anytime you want, but there's a tendency to get distracted, and there's also a tendency to be mindful of, well, the things you're interested in. And now you get the equanimity, and you can be, yeah, more steadily mindful and mindful of, yeah, a larger variety of things without getting lost. So this mindfulness purified by equanimity is what we're after here. Again, it feels like it's down. One of the things that Ayakema mentioned was that in the third jhana, it feels like you're in the mouth of a well. And then the fourth jhana, you let go and just drift down the well to the bottom. And yeah, there's that sense of going down. Maybe you're just underwater in the swimming pool and you just drift down to the bottom. Something like that. Or you're in the mouth of a cave and you go deep inside the mountain. This sense of isolation, of getting really far away from the world around you. The trick for moving, so in the third jhana, you've got the little wispy Buddha smile. First jhana, you might have a big grin, teeth showing. Second jhana, big smile, no teeth. Third jhana, Buddha smile, but still pleasure. Let go of the smile. I put my attention on the smile and just relax all the muscles in my face. And when I do, there's a sense of things starting to sink down. I put my attention on the sinking feeling and just let it sink for as long as it will go. And after 30 seconds or a minute, it comes to a place that's very quiet and very still. That's the focus of the fourth jhana. Sometimes you hear the fourth jhana is the jhana of equanimity. If I tell you, focus on equanimity, that's kind of, well, what? How? But if I tell you, focus on quiet stillness, it's a little easier to see target. And if you focus on the quiet stillness, you will be focused on the equanimity at the same time. So that becomes the object. So it's basically letting go of the pleasure of the third, going with the feeling of sinking, and ride it down to a place of quiet stillness. It says, one sits suffusing one's body with a pure, bright mind, so there is no part of one's entire body not suffused by the pure, bright mind. When I first learned this, I didn't know about this particular part of it. And when I heard Ayakema teach that, it was like, pure, bright mind. I don't get that. I get the pure. My mind was so quiet that, yeah, it was really pure. But bright? I mean, there was no hint of bright. My eyes are closed and it's just black. That's it. Where does the bright come in? Well, there's a simile. Suppose a man were to be sitting covered from the head down by a white cloth, so there would be no part of his entire body not suffused by the white cloth. In the same way, one sits suffusing one's body with a pure, bright mind, so there is no part of one's entire body not suffused by a pure, bright mind. Okay, so the picture is pretty clear. We got some guy, he's sitting there, he's got a white sheet over his head, right? Okay, I get the fact that the sheet sort of isolates you from the world around you. Yeah, by the time of the fourth jhana, the outside world has gone further away. But why a white sheet? It was dark.
It was black. What's going on here? So I asked Ayakema, and she asked me to describe the fourth jhana. And, yeah, quiet, still, dark. And she says, yeah, that's fine. Don't worry about it. So I just had to put this in, I don't know. One of the most important things to bring on the spiritual path is being comfortable with, I don't know. Because, yeah, a lot of stuff we don't know. Right? And it's actually going to be very much a hindrance if you don't know, but you think you know. Because then you're never going to find out what it was you didn't know. And so if you don't know, instead of making something up, just go, I don't know. So I had to put this in, I don't know, for 16 years. All right? And then I was on a retreat with Pawok. I mentioned him earlier, the jhana master from southern Burma. It was a month-long retreat. And I had heard, yeah, you should count on 6 months to learn his jhanas. So I wasn't expecting to learn his jhanas. But I wanted to see what he was teaching. And so I went to, you know, his teaching. And after a few days, he introduced a method of counting the breaths. His technique was follow the breath at the nostrils. And he said, breathe in, breathe out, and then count in the gap between the out and the in. So breathe in, breathe out, one. Breathe in, breathe out, two. If you get to eight, start again at one. If you get lost, start again at one. And let me know when you can do that for half an hour without getting lost. Okay. So, yeah, I played with concentration before, and it wasn't too long. I could do a half an hour and not get lost. So next interview, I told him, he says, good. Now, after half an hour, drop the counting and just stay with your breath for 3 or 4 hours. Oh. I guess it's going to be a long sit. So sitting in a chair, I could do 2 hours before it got really uncomfortable. So I decided to sit in my room. I was at IMS's Forest Refuge, and everybody has a single room. And yeah, go meditate in my room. Sit in my chair, and then when the body got too uncomfortable, I just slide over to the bed for 15, 20 minutes. And then I slide back into the chair to finish ever how long, 3, 4 hours. Well, it wasn't long. I was doing this, and I'd count, and then I'd just go to following the breath. And then I would get this huge burst of PT. I mean, it was violent shaking. I was a little afraid my head was going to pop off. Luckily, it only lasted like 10 seconds or so. But it was quite intense. And I'd get, you know, a couple of these. So the next interview with Pawok, I described what was happening. I didn't use the word PT. I just described the symptoms. And he says to me, that is gross PT. Do not let that happen. Okay. How to keep that from happening? Well, since I discovered that smiling when I meditated was a very beneficial thing, you know, I was smiling when I meditated. And it was like, okay, don't smile when you meditate. Keep it very solemn. And I could do that, and I wouldn't get those outbursts of gross PT. And I just sit there. But I noticed there was PT in the background. I go to lunch. Yeah, there's a little PT in the background. It's not far away. Yeah. Washing the dishes. Yeah, there's a little PT back there. Doing walking meditation, yeah, still a little PT back there. You know, it wasn't having these outbursts, but it was, you know, it was close by. It was just a matter I could reach out and hit the switch and it would be back, I knew. So after, you know, a week or so of playing with these 3 and 4 hour meditations, I wasn't getting his nimitta, that's what he was after. But I was getting really concentrated. And I felt, I wonder what happens if I smile. So I'd done my 3 or 4 hours like he asked, and then I smile. And I got this extreme PT, you know, like 15 seconds of violent shaking. And then it passed away, and I found myself deliriously happy. I mean, just a break-your-face smile, you know, grinning from ear to ear. And it wasn't like I had to drench deep, saturate, and suffuse. No, it was like I'd been picked up and dunked in a vat of happiness. There was happiness out to here. And it was so stable. It didn't matter what I did. It just wouldn't go away. It was, wow, very cool. It was very much the second jhana that I had learned from Ayakema, only far more intense than I had ever experienced it before. And so I hung out there for, I don't know, 5 or 10 minutes, and it was like, I wonder what the third jhana's like. Well, I couldn't go to the third jhana because, you see, these bursts of piti kept coming back. Not supposed to be any piti in the third jhana. I'd try and take a deep breath, calm down the happiness. No, here comes some more piti. I'm stuck in the second jhana. Not a bad place to be stuck, right? And then after about 20 minutes, there was a sense of things just going over the edge, and it dropped down to contentment, and no more piti came. It was like, cool, third jhana. But again, you know, dunked in contentment out to here. No need to drench, steep, saturate, or suffuse. So I hung out there for 5 minutes. It's like, what's the fourth jhana like? Couldn't get there. I couldn't wipe the smile off my face. You know, it's like, okay. It wouldn't go away. So I'm stuck in the third jhana. And then after maybe another 5 minutes, there was this sense of, yeah, it just went right over the edge. And there was a long period of dropping. And then I had quiet stillness. And it was very clearly the fourth jhana, except now it was bright white. It was like if I went out to the middle of that open field on a bright sunny day and put a white sheet over my head and opened my eyes, just like it says in the simile. Clearly, the jhanas I had been practicing before weren't to the same depth as what was being described in the suttas. That the Buddha and his monks were, yeah, probably not doing 45-minute sitting, 45-minute walking. These were people that sat cross-legged all the time. Most likely what was happening, they'd go on alms round in the morning, they would get their food, they would eat it. That was the meal for the day. And so somewhere around 10 or 11 o'clock, they would go for the day's abiding, which meant they would go into the forest or go to their little hut and sit down to meditate until it got dark. So they were sitting 3 or 4 hours, right? And they were getting super concentrated, like what I was doing. And when they got to the fourth jhana, it was bright white. The white shows up because as you get quieter in your brain, that's what happens when you get concentrated, your brain gets quieter. It's not that things stop. It's that, yeah, there's not as much activity, but there's still random activity in all parts of the brain, including your visual cortex. And if there's random firings in your visual cortex, you see it as a field of white. So if you get the diffuse white light I was talking about this morning, you are seeing that you're concentrated, literally. You're seeing that your brain has entered this random firing mode. And so I was super concentrated, and so there was a lot of random firings, and so it was bright white. And I could see that I was very, very concentrated. It was quite interesting to not only know, yeah, I'm not getting distracted, I could see how concentrated I was. On a later retreat with Powak, I could concentrate, I could track my level of concentration as I got deeper and deeper by just how bright the white light got. So you come on a 10-day retreat with me, you're probably not going to get deep enough to get the bright white light. Okay, you're going to need, yeah, probably a month, and you're going to need to already be fairly experienced with the jhanas, and then you're going to need to stay in access concentration for, well, you don't have to do 3 or 4 hours, but yeah, maybe an hour, and then you trigger the jhanas, and they'll be even deeper. When I was hanging out with Powak, not letting the piti come, basically I was hanging out in what I called access concentration, not what he called access concentration. I wasn't even near his yet, okay? But it was good enough to get me into a nice, deep spot for the jhanas as described in the suttas. But whatever level you get to, when you come out of the jhanas, you're going to find that your mind is far more concentrated and far more skilled at whatever insight practice you have to do. When one's mind is thus concentrated, pure and bright, unblemished, free from defects, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, one directs and inclines it to knowing and seeing. One understands thus, this is my body, having material form, composed of the four primary elements, originating from mother and father, built up out of rice and gruel, impermanent, subject to rubbing and pressing, to dissolution and dispersion. And this is my consciousness, supported by it and bound up with it. The purpose of doing jhana practice is to generate a mind that is concentrated, pure and bright, unblemished, free from defects, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, which you can then direct and incline to knowing and seeing. Direct and incline to investigating reality, to doing an insight practice. And what is it you're supposed to know and see? This body and this mind. Now, if you're familiar with the Satipatthana Suttas, right, the discourses on the foundations of mindfulness or the establishments of mindfulness, the first establishment is body. The second one is Vedana, the initial valence of a sensory input, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, that's mind. The third establishment is Citta, that's mind, because that's what it means. The fourth establishment is phenomena, and most of the phenomena being described are mind. The jhanas are a warm-up exercise for the Satipatthana practices. Okay, they're a warm-up exercise for insight practice in general. Somehow, being able to investigate reality and see what's really there. Getting enlightened is difficult. If we took this piece of wood that's covering the radiator here, and I had a dull knife, like a butter knife, and I wanted to cut it in two, that'd be really hard, right? I could do it. It might take a long time. It'd probably hurt my hand in the process. But if I got a whetstone and started sharpening it up, and then I started cutting, it cut a lot faster. In fact, I'd make up all the time I wasted with the sharpening, right? It's not really wasting. It's making a better tool so that it'll cut a lot faster. This is what you're doing with jhana practice. You're sharpening your mind so that when you do insight practice, you have penetrating insight into the nature of reality. In the Tibetan tradition, the bodhisattva of wisdom is Manjushri, and he's usually depicted that with a sword that he uses to cut the bonds of ignorance. Jhana practice is simply sharpening Manjushri's sword. You haven't cut any bonds of ignorance. You still got to wield it by doing insight practice. And you certainly don't want to just do jhana practice, because that means just sharpening the sword only. And if you just keep sharpening, eventually you got no sword left. Right? You get it sharp, and you go wield it. And it gets dull, and you sharpen it up again, and you go wield it. Just like cutting that with a dull knife. You sharpen it up, you cut for a while, it gets dull, you sharpen it up again. Same thing with your mind. What we're trying to do is generate a mind that will more easily gain insight into the nature of reality. I can pretty well guarantee you that the time spent getting your mind concentrated will more than be made up by both the number and the quality of the insights that come with a supremely sharpened mind. So this is what the jhana practice is about. Any questions?